Paula, you were a student at Raines. You've gone on to serve on the county school board. You have vivid memories of this process from about 25 years ago, not 60. As you think about this anniversary, what are the memories flooding your mind right now?
Well, one of the memories that's most relevant to me is the memory of my eighth grade math teacher at Joseph Stilwell, junior high at that time, giving the students, the white students, a 3x5 card. And she said on that card was her home phone number and the hours in which the students could call if they needed help. And she, you know, blatantly passed them around to all the white schools students except those of us who were in the school. And that has always stuck with me.
She didn't give you a 3x5 card.
She didn't give not one black student a 3x5.
What year was that?
That was 73. Right.
So the schools were effectively integrated at that time, but unequal policies still remained in the schools.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
Okay. Judith Papel, you wrote an historic dissertation. I read it this morning on the desegregation of Raines High School. Tell us about that project.
I was an employee for the Duval County Public Schools for many years until I retired. And I, during that period of time, became a friend and worked closely on accreditation visits with Dr. Andrew Robinson, who was the original principal at Raines High School when it was opened. And along with him, when we would go on these accreditation visits, would be some of the original faculty members that he had hired at Raines. And I would hear stories from them about how wonderful Raines had been and how it was destroyed when the desegregation order was implemented in Jacksonville. So I wanted to know more about that. And I also, at that point, began to realize that many of the players who were part of that were passing away. And soon there would be no one left to tell the story. So that was what prompted my doing my dissertation on the history of the desegregation of Raines. I also had a job at the school district. I was director of pupil assignment and later the first director of magnet schools when those were initiated in the school district. And so I was very familiar with the whole desegregation impact of the schools in Duval County. So I took off on this adventure to interview former teachers, administrators, school board members, parents, who were part of that, who had memories.
And what was the most commonly held sentiment, or was there?
Well, I think there was a commonly held sentiment that, in fact, two things. One is that Raines, in fact, was significantly impacted, particularly the faculty of Raines High School was significantly impacted by the desegregation order. The other was, one of my research questions was, well, there were two research questions. One is, would we ever be able to effectively desegregate Raines? We've tried in a couple of times and it was not lasting. And the second question was, should we try and desegregate Raines? Because it was started as a school with a sense of pride. Dr. Robinson called it his million-dollar school and constantly reminded the students that they were fortunate to have this million-dollar school in their community. And somehow desegregation affected all of that and attacked that sense of pride.
And Jim Crooks, the Brown versus Board of Ed decision came down in 1954. It took many years for that order to really wind its way through at the local level here in Jacksonville. And efforts were decidedly mixed, correct?
They were more than mixed. if you consider the fact that the school, Duval County population was three-quarters white and one-quarter African-American, in that the school board was all white and the school top school administration was all white, there was very little support for desegregation in Duval County, even when it happened in 1972-73. Throughout the 50s, the first 6 years after the decision, nothing happened. It wasn't until Earl Johnson, as the attorney for the NAACP filed suit in the early 60s, that token desegregation began. And, you know, eight little children began school in about 1963. And one of the results of that was a KKK bombing of the home in which one of the kids lived. Fortunately, the family wasn't hurt. And it wasn't until the late 60s that the courts began to listen to the suits and petitions and pleas of the African-American community to do a substantial piece of desegregation. And even then, it continued to drag its feet year after year after year. So mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that it was just one. There was really one dominant response and then one effort by the African-American community led by people like Wendell Holmes as well as Earl Johnson to try to change the situation.
And we'll go to your calls as the nation marks the 60th anniversary of the historic Brown versus Board of Ed decision. The number to join us by phone is 549-2937. And so Paula Wright, a listener, tweets the show, "The real question I'd like your guest to address now is whether the goals of Brown versus Board of Education have been met. Your thoughts?"
No. The goals, you know, stated that we were supposed to, that separate but equal was not equal.
It was not constitutional.
It's not constitutional. So today, I think that's evident. I don't think you could find, you know, very few people to say, oh, yes, we met those goals. But I think the question is why we haven't met those goals, and it's not an easy fix. Because one of the things that's important to me, and when I reflect on some of the emotional ups and downs that I endured as a student of being forced into integration, you know, being forced to always feel as if you've got to be better than everybody else, always going in having to be prepared 10 times more, you know, the additional stress, is that fair to a small group of students, whichever group that's in the minority? So, and also I want to be clear that just because we have teachers and students of diverse racial makeup does not necessarily means equal education, equal opportunity, or equal advancement.
That's the real question today, isn't it, Judith? Whether the kids in the system are all getting an equal bite at the apple, whether or not the school is integrated, whether the school is de facto segregated, fully integrated, partially integrated. That's the fundamental question right now.
I think we've come a long way. I agree with Paula. There's still issues out there, but I think we've come a long way in terms of building understanding in our community. Are there still problems? Yes, there's still definitely problems. I think my major concern is what I view happening is a resegregation of schools in our school district, which we don't live in a segregated society to the extent we did once before.
But there's voluntary segregation taking place.
Definitely. Yeah.
Jim Crooks, what about that?
Well, I think the underlying or one of the major underlying problems is the poverty of a large segment of the Jacksonville community, people who cannot afford to move out of low-income neighborhoods. Middle-class or professional African-Americans frequently can buy homes on the South Side or Riverside or the beaches and enjoy, if they enjoy suburbia, enjoy living in that part of town and their kids going to school. But people who can't afford to buy a home or cannot afford a higher rental are stuck. And whites are not moving to the North Side, anyway, south of the Trout River. And so you have a area of the town is largely black, and that results in segregated schools. And it's the economic issue is a fundamental foundation of that.
Lots of calls, meanwhile, as we take a look back at the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision. It was decided by the Supreme Court 60 years ago this weekend. What are your thoughts? 549-2937. Let's go to Michelle in Jacksonville. She's on the line. Hey, Michelle, thanks for calling. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I've heard over the past years about Raines High School. I was there from 1979 till 1981. The last 6 months of my high school education was at Andrew Jackson. And I have to tell you, Jimmy Johnson was our principal, and I'm a proud Viking. The curriculum there was excellent. we were expected to act a certain way, even our rival Revolt, you know, which I'm sure is still longstanding rivalry, is, you know, they always called us, oh, well, you act like you're in college, or, you know, you carry yourself a certain way, and that went on beyond high school and into college. But the segregation, you know, it's just sad to see, because it's such a wonderful school. It has so much to offer, and the total opposite. Andrew Jackson, when I was there my last 6 months of high school, there were fights, constant racial strife. It wasn't that welcoming environment that I had at Raines. And if your host could elaborate on that, just the difference, you know.
Thanks for that. That's Michelle in Jacksonville. And we invite everyone calling in to share their memories like she did. Paula Wright.
Well, you know, I think that Michelle hit a very important point for me. And as a policymaker, for me, the most important thing right now is strong schools that provide a quality education for every student every day, because we cannot control the demographics, and we cannot control the patterns, the residential patterns. So what's the next step? What's the best next thing? And that is to ensure that we have policies in place where diversity becomes the norm. And I think Judy is right. It is not there yet, but there is, we have seen a lot of improvement. Even from a student perspective, from my first year and being a part of a classroom that was, you know, that the teacher decided to separate and segregate to move on to the high school, Ed White High School, where at 3-4 years later, more acceptance had, you know, the whites accepted us more. We accepted, you know, the whites more. And we bonded. When I left Ed White and graduated in 77, there was a bond. And I still am in contact with some of the students today. So now, how do we ensure that Raines is Raines, regardless of the population of students, or in spite of or because of the population of students?
That's the challenge you were just getting at.
Yes, and I think there's another piece to this, and I imagine Paul and Judy would agree, is who the principal is, or what is the leadership in a particular school. Going back to Raines, when Andy Robinson was principal and his successors, they had outstanding leadership. And you can see that now in certain high schools. My wife was volunteering at Lee High School this past year, and the leadership there was extraordinary. And it changes the whole atmosphere of an institution. And that gets to part of what I think you're talking about at Ed White as well.
Judith Papel.
I agree wholeheartedly. The leadership of the school sets the tone and creates the climate and culture in that school. And Dr. Robinson and Dr. Bryant and those that followed him believed really strongly that this school was a source of pride in that community and built that pride in the students.
Let's go down to Clay County. It's Clue on the line. Is that your name, Clue?
Yes, ma'am. Good morning.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I didn't go to school in Jacksonville. I went to school in St. Augustine. I was born and raised there. And I can tell you from the experience, you know, when we went to school, there was a bunch of elementary schools. But once you got to a certain grade level, doesn't matter where you lived in the county, everybody went to the same fifth grade school, the same sixth grade school, and it wasn't segregated. So there, everybody knew each other. Everybody became friends, and we grew up together. And so we didn't have that segregation there. And you know, I wanted to touch on that because I wanted to find out if it was in the bigger cities or the bigger counties, if the segregation is more prevalent in them areas. Because back in St. Augustine, you know, we didn't have the population back then, maybe as Duval County or some other counties had. And then I'll take that question, you know, off
there. Sure. Thanks for that. That's a good question. So different cities had different experiences. Yes?
Well, I would jump in here and say that one of the challenges we face in Jacksonville and Duval County is simply the size of our school district. Because our city is so large geographically, regardless of how you split up the boundaries and make those attempts, you're still going to have neighborhoods like Jim described that are going to be poverty-ridden and segregated based on racial patterns and
yes,
so forth.
Calls, emails, and tweets about that. Frank emails the show, Dr. Crooks makes an excellent point about how poverty impacts the legacy of Brown versus Board of Ed in Jacksonville. If we ignore the issues related to poverty, educational opportunities will never be equal in the city. Let's go to David in Ponte Vedra. He's on the line. Hi, David. Thanks for your call. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, guys. Mrs. Poppel.
Yes.
David Silver from Fletcher.
Well, hi, David.
How's Coach doing?
He's doing well, thank you.
Okay, great. Well, I'm 67, graduated 65. And I remember, in a way, here at the beaches, where we had busing in reverse. I believe
correct.
The black community had to bus all the children into Jacksonville. And I'm wondering what school that it was that they went to.
That is correct, David. You've got a pretty good memory. Prior to the desegregation order's implementation in Jacksonville, there was a black elementary school that went through grade 8. It's the old Jacksonville Beach Elementary School, which is now a magnet school. And high school students were bused to Douglas Anderson on the south side, which was a considerable distance.
In the days of busing, Jim Crooks and Paula Wright, people still have vivid memories of
yes.
that, although it's not the same today as it was in those years.
Right. I certainly have vivid memories in terms of being, I was at James Weldon Johnson, which was two doors from my home, to Steelwell and then later to Ed White. And I always felt somewhat abused.
Yeah.
Having to get up, you know, an hour earlier, ride an hour.
Right.
And then to be, you know, confronted with eggs and racial slurs, et cetera, as an eighth grader. So integration, in terms of my perspective, did more to harm the unity, the connectivity within the black community than anything that I can recall.
So you see it, although it was well-intentioned,
yes.
you see it as having some destructive effects.
Well, even beyond that, African-American children in the city were bused to suburban schools. We lived out near Beauclair School at the time, and their parents couldn't come out to PTA events. They couldn't come out easily to teachers' conferences. And so there was that disconnect of the teachers with the parents because they were in different sides of town.
Let's go to Reverend Tommy Rogers on the west side. Tommy Rogers, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa, and good morning to your panel as well. One of the things that concerns me, and I've talked about this considerably, is the issue of segregating success as well. I think success has been segregated more nowadays than anything. If we had schools in these affected areas that were your model schools that were leaders in technology, leaders in resources, the buildings were modernized, I think that might help, because quality does drive where we send our kids to school, even when we talk about different choices that we make. The other thing, too, that we have not talked about is the breakdown of the family structure. I know particularly growing up, that my family was a real key in how I actually performed in school. So I knew, well, first off, my mom was a teacher, so if I acted up in school, I would get, you know, this was when we could get spanked at school, and particularly if it was my mom's friend, I knew I was going to get it, that she would call home before I get home, and then I knew I had something waiting on me at home as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the family structure, as well as, you know, if people in Palm Beach and Mandarin heard that Reigns was the top school, they would fight to get in Reigns the way they're fighting to get into Stanton and Paxton right now as well. And I think these are some of the things that we have to consider as well, making desegregating success in our school.
Thank you for that. And that is Reverend Rogers over on the west side.
Well, an example of that, though, is both Stanton and Douglas Anderson were among the outstanding black schools during the segregated era. And they were made magnet schools. They've become very successful in that role.
There is a difference, however, that we found in implementing magnet schools in the school district. Stanton and Douglas Anderson are both what we called dedicated magnet schools. They have no assigned attendance area, although the neighborhood students get preference. They're not automatically mm-hmm. assigned there. And everyone in the school district has an equal opportunity to apply to be accepted there. Other magnet schools, other schools like Reigns, when we implemented a magnet program there, only affected a small percentage of the students in that school.
Let's go to Mark on the south side. Hi, Mark. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I would just like to point out that it seems like everybody on your panel kind of realizes what the real problem is, and that's funding for our schools. But nobody wants to actually talk about the fact that our schools are funded by property taxes. And, I mean, in the city, property tax is going to be different depending on where you are. And then we like to fund our schools by people's gambling habits? Why don't we fund our schools through the general funds, tax people if you want your kids to be educated?
What do you mean gambling, Mark?
Like, because part of our Florida lottery system.
Oh, I see. Sure, sure, sure. Thank you for the call, Mark. All right, Paula Wright, let's talk about that for a minute. The funding formula for the schools and how, despite our the American way is seeing everyone having an equal access and to an equal educational experience, it's just not the reality.
Well, the funding is determined by the legislature and through FTE dollars, and each student receives about, or the district receives about $6,000 for each student. So there is supposedly no disparity in terms of how much money each student receives for an education. The issues are, for instance, to go back to segregating success, Stanton is an old building. It's not updated, but the lines are around the corner to get into it. So it's what is produced between the walls which drives people to come. So how do we make all of our schools Stantons?
That's right. That is the challenge that we talk about on this program all the time. Jim and Judith, your final thoughts.
My final thoughts, I'm concerned that many of our schools are resegregating, particularly those in the northwest area of our city. And students who attend schools that are segregated with only one population are not prepared to live in a diverse society such as we have today. I think we have to find a way to create more interaction for students of all races.
James Crooks.
I think we have really good leadership right now in the Duval County Public Schools. I think that we have a very real problem with the high poverty rate in the Duval County Public Schools among the people. And we also have to recognize that the schools can't do it alone, that they can't solve the poverty problem, they can't solve some of the mental health problems, that the community has to wrap their arms around the children of Duval County in order to enable them to succeed.
Thank you all three of you for being with us to mark this important anniversary. We appreciate it. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.